From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and NPR is confirming today that an aide to Vice President Mike Pence has tested positive for COVID-19. This is the third known case at the White House, and we will continue to follow that story.
We're also getting the latest picture yet today of how the economy is weathering this pandemic, and it's looking pretty bleak. More than 20 million Americans lost their jobs in April, according to the Labor Department. 14.7% of Americans are now out of work. Here's economist Austin Goolsbee reacting on CNBC this morning.
That level is lower than at the height of the Great Depression, but in terms of the speed at which it happens, it's worse than the Great Depression. This has got to be the most heartbreaking day in the history of the job market.
And yet the stock market has been higher today. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I guess one of the big questions here is, with this just devastating report, is how many of these job losses are temporary furloughs versus how many are permanent? Do we know?
Yeah, and it's a great point. The vast majority are temporary, or at least being classified as temporary. About 18.1 million are classified as temporary, 2 million as permanent. Obviously, the risk is that some of those temporary layoffs turn into something more permanent. So that is the big question.
And we remember back in March, most of the job losses were in industries like the restaurant industry and tourism. What are we seeing in this report about which industries were affected by the job losses?
Yeah, that leisure and hospitality group, again, was among the hardest hit. They lost about 7.7 million jobs, mainly in bars and restaurants, that type of thing. But it's a very widespread weakness throughout basically almost every industry in this report. For example, the arts and entertainment and recreation industry lost 1.3 million. And even professional and business services, you know, what you consider sort of good white-collar jobs, lost like 2.1 million jobs. So the weakness is spread out pretty much across almost the entire economy.
We're also getting a snapshot today of the racial and gender breakdown of these job losses. What can you tell us about that?
It does seem like women and minorities are getting hit a little bit harder in this situation. For example, the unemployment rate for adult men was 13%. For adult women, it was 15.5%, and the rate was 17% for African Americans and almost 19% for Hispanics. So it definitely hitting those groups harder than the sort of adult male population.
And it was about 14.2% for white Americans when it comes to the unemployment rate. Meanwhile, Mike, the stock market, with this terrible news, the worst jobs report in most people's lifetimes, the stock market's up. Why?
Well, there's just been so much money put into the system by the Federal Reserve to sort of counteract the economic damage and the government stimulus efforts. You know, think about those checks that people are receiving in the mail. That said, there is a lot of debate about whether, you know, the market is being a little too optimistic about all this. A lot of people are skeptical of this rebound in the market that we've seen. It's kind of common in bear markets for there to be these really sharp rebounds that prove to be only temporary. So we'll have to just see what happens.
Now, you use that word again, temporary, and let me go back to sort of where we started with this, which is how permanent this situation is going to be. One of the White House's economic advisors says that he thinks that the unemployment rate is going to go up into the 20s in terms of percentage, and J.P. Morgan is saying that it might take 10 years to fully recover. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, I think in order to recoup all of these lost jobs, the discussion is definitely in years rather than months. So much depends on how things proceed when the economy does sort of reopen in earnest. you know, not only the risk of another wave of the virus flaring up and sort of causing some of these lockdown measures to be reimposed, but also just that there's a lot of question about consumer behavior. Will it be changed for, say, the next year or longer because of this? Will people sort of be afraid to go back to restaurants and movie theaters and stadiums and that sort of thing? So that is a really big question mark that economists just really can't quantify at the moment, unfortunately.
That is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Doctors in the U.S. and abroad are reporting clusters of children hospitalized with a rare and serious inflammatory syndrome that shares features with Kawasaki disease and also toxic shock syndrome. Infectious disease specialists say it's too early to say whether the illness is linked to COVID-19, but there is speculation the two are related. And that's because some of the kids who exhibit these symptoms also tested positive for the coronavirus, and others tested positive for antibodies that show they were previously infected. Dr. Sunil Sood is an infectious disease specialist and chair of pediatrics at Northwell Health's Southside Hospital in Bayshore, New York, and at Cohen Children's Hospital. And Dr. Sood joins us via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dr., New York City has 15 reported cases and 64 potential cases throughout your state. You've treated more than half a dozen patients with this rare condition at Cohen Children's Hospital. Tell us what you're seeing.
So, last week, almost exactly 1 month after the epidemic began to peak in New York and Long Island, about two dozen children have come into our hospitals with severe symptoms that initially suggested something called Kawasaki disease. Those symptoms included high fever, bright red rashes, red eyes, and some children had swollen hands and feet. And some children were sick enough that they had to be cared for in the intensive care unit.
You have said, though, that you're not sure if this is Kawasaki. Tell us why.
So Kawasaki disease occurs in about 1 in 1,000 children in the U.S. under the age of 5 years. The majority of these children were older than 5 years old, and also they did not have all the classic symptoms that accompanied Kawasaki disease. And also the percentage of children who actually needed intensive care because of depressed functioning of the heart was much higher than we see in Kawasaki disease. So that made me think that this is actually a wider spectrum of disease occurring after the initial coronavirus infection.
I see. We've been hearing that France's health minister says pediatricians and critical care medics in his country are investigating links between this disease and COVID-19. What are your thoughts? Do you anticipate that there's going to be a connection?
So I think we know almost for sure there is a connection for two reasons. One, children have been quarantined at home since the middle of March, since schools were closed, and we are really not seeing anything else going around. So the usual other spring viral infections are all coming up negative in all these children. And so the other thing, we did a quick research study last week, and the usual nasopharyngeal, you know, the nose swab PCR test, is actually negative in, I would say, 90, 95% of these children. But we use a locally standardized antibody test developed by Northwell Health, and it actually showed that they were positive. That means they fought off the COVID virus a few weeks ago.
There's also this theory that this could be the same kind of inflammatory response we're seeing in adults who experience this so-called cytokine storm with COVID-19, where the body essentially launches an all-out war on the virus, causing severe lung and organ damage. Your thoughts on this?
So we actually saw children in the first part of this outbreak with the cytokine storm picture, which was affecting the lungs. So the classic COVID pneumonia that we've all learned happens. But these children do not have that classic cytokine storm picture. They do have elevated inflammatory markers in the blood, but one of them specifically is a marker called troponin, which is a marker of heart muscle inflammation. These we're not calling cytokine storm. We're just saying that they have very high levels of many inflammatory markers in their blood, but it seems to be affecting other organs, in this case, predominantly the heart, as well as the skin, eyes, hands, and feet. Also, a lot of these children have come in with fever and severe abdominal pain, symptoms that actually mimic appendicitis.
We know kids make up a small portion of very sick COVID patients, an even smaller percentage of those hospitalized. But does this give you pause about the idea of kids who might be going back to school before the end of this year, or kids heading to summer camp?
Like you said, the number is small as a percentage, but this manifestation of the disease is quite severe. So while I would say that parents should not panic, we will be looking out for pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome that we're calling it. And I think my advice to parents is that if your child has persistent high fever for more than 2 or 3 days, and any of a whole list of symptoms, which includes stomach pains, mental confusion, diarrhea, red eyes, a rash, breathing difficulty, of course, and some children have actually passed out, you need to go straight to an emergency room, preferably a pediatric or children's hospital emergency room. And even if they don't think that they've been exposed to the virus, actually, they probably already have. That could be life-saving. Sometimes we do need to support the heart with some medications.
That's Dr. Sunil Sood, Chair of Pediatrics at Northwell Health's Southside Hospital in Bayshore, New York, where he's now treated more than half a dozen patients with this rare Kawasaki disease-like condition. Dr. Sood, thank you.
Thank you very much.
President Trump praised Attorney General William Barr on Fox News today, calling Barr a man of unbelievable credibility and courage. He was responding to the Justice Department's move yesterday to drop charges against Michael Flynn, the president's former national security advisor. Flynn had pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with a Russian ambassador. Joining us now is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, first of all, what do you make of this Flynn news?
Well, what I make of it first and foremost is that the president doesn't like issuing pardons for people who've been convicted in his Justice Department, even if it was under the special prosecutor's domain. But the other thing I make of it is that there's going to be a huge morale problem in the Justice Department. This is really unprecedented. The only similar kind of thing I can think of, and it really isn't similar, is when Eric Holder, the Democratic Attorney General in the Obama administration, dropped charges against the Republican Senator Ted Stevens, who'd been convicted, in a very messy trial where the judge kept pressing about prosecutorial misconduct, and then more stuff came out. And Holder thought that it was just a travesty of justice, and he dropped the charges. And afterwards, there actually was an investigation of misconduct. This is nothing like that. First of all, this is Bill Barr, who has done the president's bidding in many controversial ways. And this is definitely the most controversial. And, you know, I've covered the department on and off for decades, and I just... Not since Watergate, where they hid what they were doing because they were doing the president's bidding. Here they're right out in front.
We will continue to watch what happens with that story. But I want to ask you about what's happening with the Supreme Court, because this has just been an extraordinary week with the court having oral arguments over the phone. What struck you this week as you listened to the court?
Well, it was a very different kind of argument, super organized, because it has to be. They can't see each other, counsel can't see them, so they go in order of seniority. And it was interesting, and it was great for the public to hear it. But I suspect they'll be very glad when they can resume oral arguments next year, assuming they can, and see counsel, and counsel can see them. I mean, these are very big cases. And next week are some of the biggest of the term, the Trump subpoena cases, a big case involving the Electoral College, and a big religion case. And this past week, we had a big case involving Obamacare and birth control. So these are some of the most consequential cases of the term. They have to be done this way. I'm quite sure that the court will not be able to finish by the end of June, as it usually does, that it will go well into July.
Nina, there was also the news this week that the 87-year-old Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was hospitalized because of a gallbladder condition. She has been released from the hospital, but she has had a number of health issues recently. What are you hearing about this? What should we make of this latest news?
Well, you know, she's fragile. She's 87 years old. She is tough as nails and hasn't dropped a stitch in her brain. But her little body is littler than ever, and it's subject to assault. But she participated very vociferously in arguments on Wednesday from Johns Hopkins Hospital. She just seems to tough it out.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Nina. While the court was dealing with so many things this week, the Senate has been confirming the president's judicial nominees at a record pace. This week, there was a hearing on Justin Walker, a 37-year-old district court judge nominated for a seat on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. There's a lot of controversy about him.
He's an extremely controversial choice. First of all, he's nominated for the D.C. Circuit, and most of the time, those nominees come from the District of Columbia or the surrounding areas and are specialists, to some extent, in administrative law. He's 37 years old. He's from Kentucky. He's an ally of Mitch McConnell. He's been a district court judge for a relatively for quite a short time and was found unqualified for that position by the American Bar Association. I think I saw that now he's been rated qualified or well qualified for the Court of Appeals seat. What's interesting to me about this is how the Republicans have not only abolished filibuster rules, actually the Democrats at the end of the Obama administration abolished the filibuster rules for lower court judges because they were being almost universally blocked by McConnell. So the Republicans come in, they abolish the filibuster rule for the Supreme Court, and eventually they also abolish all the other sort of minor procedural rules that would allow the opposition party to drag things out. So there really is no way for the Democrats to slow down the Walker train, no matter how controversial he is. And in a time of pandemic, it's very hard to get the public's attention about a judicial nominee. It's hard in the best of times. It's really hard in these times.
That is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thank you.
You're welcome.
Many factories around the country have been shuttered by the coronavirus, but some are still operating, taking precautions to keep workers safe. One is Zurich Manufacturing Corporation in Mount Kisco, New York, in Westchester County. It was deemed an essential business. Joining us now is Gretchen Zurich, who is the company's president. Her grandfather founded the company in 1919. Gretchen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, first, tell us what your company makes and why it has been deemed an essential business.
We make electronic connectors, so little metal parts that are part of printed circuit boards, for the most part, in almost everything. But we are part of a number of products that are considered essential, especially now, things like air conditioning systems, heating systems, air handling systems, all the things that they're putting in hospitals now as they try to develop these negative pressure wards. So we're part of that type of equipment.
And how many people do you have working in one single factory?
We have about 55 people here in Mount Kisco.
And how have you been able to make it so that they can do their jobs and maintain social distancing at the same time?
We have almost 50,000 square feet, so there's a lot of space between people, just in general. And not everybody is in. Obviously, some people are nervous about being here. A few people who could work from home are. And everyone is just trying to keep their distance from the next person. So our work centers are large. People are fairly spread out. And when they need to consult with someone where they really do need to look at a machine together, they are putting on masks and gloves if necessary and still trying to stand some distance apart and one at a time look at the problem.
And has that worked for you so far? There haven't been any issues with that kind of change in how business is done?
No. It may take a little longer to get some things done. I think we're all trying to be very patient.
Well, I guess I'm asking that question because there are so many factories in this country that are dealing with this very issue, as you've heard about the meatpacking plants, and there have ended up being COVID-19 outbreaks in many plants. They've had to close. President Trump has ordered workers to go back in. How do you avoid a situation like that?
Well, we're not an assembly line, so that makes it easy to begin with. We have a tool room where people are working on tools. Everybody has their own bench. The benches are a good 4 or 5 feet apart, and people are rarely at the bench with another person either in front of or behind them at the same time because they're off working on a grinder or a milling machine or measuring something. So the tool room, they're not on top of one another. In the press department, each operator manages four presses, so he's in a very large amount of space, and every press has a house around it to reduce the sound. So, again, more privacy, more space between people. We have a couple of other departments that do assembly work, plating. We aren't doing a handoff from one person to the next.
And yet you still have some employees who don't feel safe enough to come to work.
We are in New York.
Right, right.
So we've been hit hard in New York. Obviously, the numbers got very high very quickly. And almost everybody knows someone who is sick. So people are nervous.
Have you had any employees test positive for COVID?
We have.
And how are they doing?
The first three are back to work today.
Wow. How has the coronavirus affected your business? Have you had any drop in demand for your products?
Yes. Many of our customers have been closed, some of them for a month, some of them only for a few weeks. Many are seeing their own demands drop, so they've pushed out their orders. So I would say our bookings for the month of April were about one-third of what I would have expected. Shipments were about 60%. So people seem to not be looking ahead. They can't say what I'm going to need next month.
Mm-hmm.
They still took 60% of what I would have expected them to take in the month. So they were still taking their orders, but they weren't planning ahead.
Well, as you try to plan ahead, do you think that the coronavirus pandemic is going to have a long-term impact on your business and how you run your factory?
I think it'll have a long-term effect on the business because I think demand will be down for quite a while. I think it will take months to recover from this. But how we run the factory? Only in a very few spots. We'll probably try and keep people working a little further apart or at least give them the option to work further apart from the person who would have been right next to them. But we have a lot of space for the number of people. We used to run in this same facility, the same level of production, with 110 people. So we're half the number of people we mm-hmm. used to be and half the number of people the building was designed for. That gives us extra space. We're very lucky.
That is Gretchen Zierich, who is president of Zierich Manufacturing in Mount Kisco, New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, the company started in 1919. This is not their first pandemic.
And in the last 2 weeks, COVID-19 cases have quadrupled in Texas immigration detention centers. Many of those cases can be traced back to immigration transfers. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovel tracks how the coronavirus made its way from one facility to another.
Hope isn't sure when she'll see her boyfriend again. They've been a couple for 5 years and were raising their son together in Houston.
I say it's going to take a long time before we meet with dad again.
Hope says her boyfriend was arrested after an argument got physical back in March. He was taken to Harris County Jail, where he was held for about 6 weeks, right when COVID-19 began to spread in Texas.
He was placed on quarantine himself, like him and I guess whatever floor he was on, because they had a positive inmate.
Hope tried to bail her boyfriend out, but immigration officials transferred him to one of their facilities for deportation. He came to the U.S. from Mexico as a kid without authorization. That's why Hope asked that we keep their identities anonymous. Officials took Hope's boyfriend to an immigration detention center in Livingston, Texas.
Once he got into ICE, he struck a 104.1 fever, and he had the symptoms, but they did not test him.
He told Hope he was feeling sick and had to share a room with at least two other men before ICE separated him from other detainees. So if he had COVID-19, he could have spread it. But he doesn't know because he was never tested. Still, ICE says it can trace its first positive COVID-19 case at the Livingston facility back to the Harris County Jail, 70 miles away. Now Livingston has at least 12 positive cases. This is one way COVID-19 is spreading to immigrant detention centers, but the spread is also coming from facilities in other states.
Instead of them releasing people, they transferred them across the country.
Shauna McLean is an immigration lawyer in New York. Her client, Behzad Jalili, had been detained in upstate New York where officials were trying to contain a COVID-19 outbreak when suddenly...
Well, I was notified, but I was notified after the decision was made on a Friday night at about 8:45 or 9 o'clock or something by email. And it was simply just a transfer notification.
Overnight, McLean says her client and other detainees were transferred from New York to a detention center 30 miles south of Fort Worth, a facility that quickly became a hotbed for infection. It went from zero cases to now at least 42, more cases than any other ICE facility in Texas. Among the migrant population, the disease is also crossing international borders. Authorities in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, have traced more than a dozen COVID-19 cases at a migrant shelter there back to a man who was deported from the Houston area.
You really shouldn't be transferring people between facilities if you have any positives.
Dr. Donna Kim Murphy has been demanding the release of people from detention since the outbreak started. Murphy is a neurologist and immigrant health advocate. She says someone can carry the virus for 2 weeks without showing symptoms, and others never show symptoms, so authorities can never really safely transfer any detainee who has been exposed to the disease.
With people who are constantly transferred between facilities, new people who are entering facilities, the staff who are actually traveling between facilities, it's very likely that you will have, at some point, the introduction of the infection into these populations, which then are kind of like tinderboxes.
Murphy says if it remains business as usual in these facilities, we'll see the disease continue to spread. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Trofall in Houston.
And there was a time when nothing could replace a good record store. In fact, it's still a one-of-a-kind experience. The exploration and discovery, the smell of thousands of records curated by fellow music nerds, and the feeling of physically touching a vinyl record. There's a place in Seattle that's offered this experience for nearly 40 years, and soon it will be closing. Bop Street Records, once named one of the top 5 record stores in the country, has been hit hard by COVID-19. And its owner, Dave Voorhees, says now is as good a time as ever to close. And Dave joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Well, Dave, you started selling records, I read, from your parents' basement way back in 1974. You've owned and operated Bop Street Records since 79, settling in the neighborhood of Ballard back in 84. And, you know, I lived in Seattle for about a decade, and I used to frequent your store. We're talking 500,000 records you've got in there. I'm just thinking, what are you feeling right now? I mean, this store has been such a part of you for most of your life.
Well, I'll tell you, it's pretty surreal. That's probably the best term I can use. When you're used to a certain routine of getting up in the morning and going to work and turning off the alarm and turning on, you know, putting the open sign out there and turning on some music and just waiting to talk to customers, it's going to be a strange feeling when I look in this location and it's empty, and it may not have actually struck me yet.
Yeah. How has COVID-19 impacted your business? It's really influenced your decision not to renew your lease.
We had actually thought we were going to renew the lease, but once it hit, we decided not to. I respect Governor Inslee and Mayor Durkin as far as putting some restrictions on non-essential, although I always feel a record store is an essential business, but
yeah.
they've deemed them non-essential. So it's affected my business immensely. I don't have any foot traffic. And then also the main thing, about 80% of my customers are first-time buyers from Europe, from some place where you'd have to arrive by plane.
So you'll be selling online. I am just thinking about the task of getting 500,000 records out of a retail store. And then where will they go?
Well, let me give a shout out to the Seattle Goodwill.
Which is the best one in the country, by the way. I want to throw that out there.
It's a good one. The one down on Dearborn, the one downtown.
Yep.
They picked up 40 boxes last week. That's 4,000. But tomorrow they're coming to pick up over 120,000 boxes, which would be 12,000 more records. They're not going to a dump or something like that. They're going to go from my store to be able to be bought at the Goodwill. So we appreciate that.
Well, as I mentioned, Bob Street Records has been named one of the best record stores in the country. And a lot has to do with the collection that you've curated over the years. I mean, it's really about you and your tastes. So I want to know, how did your passion for music first start? And what was the first album you ever owned?
My first 45 I ever bought was a Fats Domino 45 when I was 8. Mm. And then the first record I ever got, which is the initial question you asked me, for my 10th birthday in December of 59, I got the Buddy Holly story. He had just died in February of that year, so about 10 months early. And I listened to that thing over and over and over. Sometimes if I hear a particular song, Buddy Holly's song, I'll expect to hear the next song on the album, because I had just... It was sort of ingrained to me, the sequence, the order that those songs were on the record.
Yeah. You know, that's a classic. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
All of my love, all of my kissing, you don't know what you've been missing. Oh boy,
oh boy,
when you're with me, oh boy,
oh boy,
the whole world can see that you were meant for me. All of my life, I've been waiting. Tonight there'll be no.
Dave, you can't see me, but I'm like dancing and lip syncing the songs.
One time I actually entered a lip sync contest singing, oh boy, I mean lip syncing to that song, oh boy. Yeah. I didn't
win. It's a good one.
I had a mustache at the time. It looked a lot more like Weird Al Yankovic, but anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, I know I'm younger than you, but that kind of song is such a classic. I don't know, you know, it just spans generations. You know the words, you know the beat. The moment the beat drops, you know it.
You bet. You bet.
In some ways, it's almost like you stumbled into records as a way of life, though, right? I mean, how did it come to be that you uncovered 3,000 rare blues records when you started selling? That's amazing.
Sure, I can tell you. What happened was I was working at a used record store, and a guy came in with a shoebox full of just incredible blues 45s. And so I asked him, where'd you get these? He said, my brother lives in Houston. There's a little town called Angleton, Texas. And there was a jukebox distributor there with 100,000 45s for a dime apiece. So a friend of mine and I, after about a week of knowing about this, we drove down there. We spent 8 hours a day, 3 days in a row, so a total of 24 hours. There were little silverfish scurrying around. There was a dead mouse in the corner of this big warehouse. And at the end of each day, you'd blow your nose, and it's just like dust and dirt. But I've had a lot of highlights in my life, but that was one of the highlights. It was just pretty incredible. I should have bought them all, but I didn't. But I bought 3,000 of them for $300, and I shipped them back to Seattle. And within about 2 weeks, I'm selling them out of my parents' basement for, I'm going to say, $2 to $10 a piece. In addition, people I don't even know are sort of calling me off the hook. You know, it's like, hey, you know, my friend Terry was at your house. You know, can I come see your records, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a cool way to start.
Talk about a cool way to start. Absolutely.
Yeah,
one of those rare 45s or singles was Otis Rush's I Can't Quit You, Baby. Let's take a listen.
What? Baby, that I gotta put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, baby.
Dave, I want to be on somebody's porch down in the South with a good drink listening to this song. I mean, this
sure,
is so
sure,
good.
Sure. And actually, he started out in the South, but he moved to Chicago in the mid-50s along with Magic Sam and Shaky Jake. And this is on the label called the Cobra label. But he was an incredible left-handed guitarist, influenced Hendrix, influenced a lot of the more, you know, the later guitarists because he was so good.
Yeah, that song is from 1954, which in some ways you have found an archive. And that's what your store has really become for so many folks who have come to visit. And you've had some big names come to your store. I mean, regular everyday folks like me, but also folks like Questlove, even possibly Oprah. You must have some really good stories.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can tell you a few. One of the early ones was Robert Crumb, of course, the cartoonist, R. Crumb.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, he did the cover for Cheap Thrills, and he's an inveterate 78 collector. And he came in, probably spent 6 hours at one of my locations. At the end of the day, he brings down a big stack of records, and I and said, do you know what you want for these? I said, oh, I don't know. Would you take $75 for them? I said, sure. It's probably about $1,000. Well, maybe $500 worth of records. But he was cool. I enjoyed meeting him and talking to him. And he actually signed a couple of records for me. So that was cool. I've also had Ben Gibbard used to come in from Death Cab one time. He said, oh, Dave, this is my fiance, Zoe. Well, it was Zoe Deschanel. I didn't know that. Just, oh, hello, nice to meet you, Zoe. Dave Grohl, okay, about 2 weeks after Kurt died, guy comes into my store who I recognize, and he knows that I know who he is. But he says, I hear you've been selling this rare Nirvana set. I looked at him. I said, who's asking? Just joking, you know. And he bought it. He bought it from me. So, yeah, it's just been the greatest.
Well, Bob Street is closing its doors. It really feels like the end of an era, especially when we think about what the store was named after, Bob Street by Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps. Let's listen.
Hey, Cat, where you going, man?
Man, I'm going down to Bob Street.
Tell me, Cat, where's that direction?
Man, ain't you heard? They got one of them in every town.
Real cool.
Bob Street.
Oh, Dave. I mean, what do you want your legacy to be?
Well, I would say just that I try to find music for people and welcomed them into my store and made them feel comfortable. I'm getting kind of tearful here. I had a guy call me on the phone just a few days, and he was actually crying, and he said, I can't express how much joy you brought to me.
Absolutely. We thank you for giving us this experience for so many years. So you're going to be missed, but you're still around, and you got to be the human algorithm now online for folks. That's what's going to happen. Thank you so much for joining us today. That's Dave Voorhees, owner of Bob Street Records in Seattle.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now. While the coronavirus is dominating social media, another story has captured the country's focus. Video of the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia was leaked to the public this week and has sparked a call for justice. The 25-year-old unarmed black man was killed by a former officer, Gregory McMichael, and his son, Travis, back in February while Ahmaud Arbery was out jogging. The McMichaels said they suspected Arbery of burglary. They were finally arrested last night and charged with murder. Joining us now to discuss this and other stories trending on social media is Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And I know that one of the hashtags you're seeing around the shooting is justice for Ahmaud Arbery. The case did not get a lot of attention when it happened, but the video really has changed that. What are people saying online?
Yeah, and we've seen this before, Jeremy, where people are incensed when video is released on social media or it's leaked. For instance, Eric Garner in New York or Laquan McDonald in Chicago. And when people see what happens on the scene and then they link it to this shouldn't happen, that is where social is rallying around. For instance, I'm just looking at what people are saying about Ahmaud. Belinda posts online, this young man deserves to have his killers brought to justice for this senseless killing. Crystal says, and she signed a petition to ask for justice. I'm signing because I'm the mother of an upstanding, law-abiding man of colour. I am seeing threads being started and conversations being started by veteran social justice activists like Linda Sasour and Sean King as well.
Yeah, you know, I've even seen some people changing their profile picture on social media to have a picture of Ahmaud Arbery. What else are you seeing?
This is very painful. People showing a lot of pain. They're showing their pictures of their little boys, their little boys of color. Sometimes they're blended families, and so there will be children who are white and children who are black, and they are fearful of their children who are black. Hashtags to look out for, justice for Ahmaud Arbery, justice for Ahmaud, and a very unusual hashtag that was trending on Thursday, Martin Luther Kim. And I thought, what is this? And I went to look, and it was Kim Kardashian who was also posting her support. And why Martin Luther Kim? Well, that's because Kim Kardashian has become a social justice warrior in her own right and has really made some changes and impact because she's able to go to the White House and current president right. Really relates very well to celebrities.
Let's talk about some of the other things trending. And of course, we have to talk about the coronavirus pandemic. Now, many stores are mandating that customers wear masks when they are shopping. That includes Costco. And some people have been on social media complaining about that policy, even calling for a boycott of Costco. What are they saying?
There is a battle right now about Costco and its mask policy. They also introduced some other policies as well. For instance, special shopping hours for seniors. Two warring conversations support Costco. Here's Susan Mattson as an example of that. I went to Costco after avoiding the warehouse store for 2 months. It was a huge relief to shop in a place where everyone was wearing a mask. And then from the boycott Costco, posts with sheep wearing masks, I did say sheep, Naughty Angler, for instance, says, Costco, I will not be told I'm required to wear a mask to shop with you. You've made a tactical error. Boycott Costco. And then in the middle of this face mask battle, a tweet that's doing really well from a disgruntled Costco member who declares that she is not going to shop in the store until the mask policy is dropped. Costco replies, thank you for taking such a brave stand, Sharon. We look forward to the documentary they will make about you someday. I know you're going, Sharon asks for her membership money back and Costco refuses. And it turns out that this delicious burn is actually a piece of satire and not true at all. But those two hashtags I did tell you about, support Costco, boycott Costco, they're absolutely true. Check them out online.
One more thing, Femi. Everybody's been talking about the murder hornets. These are giant Asian hornets that were recently spotted in Washington State. But now social media has shown us there may be a way to defeat them, and it has to do with the praying mantis.
Find yourself a praying mantis and then that will get rid of your Asian giant hornet. So there's this video that's doing the rounds and it's a beautiful video. It's been shared by Nature is Metal. Praying mantis eats murder hornet, if you want to go and look at it. So you have your praying mantis in a very sort of clinical setting, grabs the murder hornet, clenches it very tightly and then starts nibbling around its head area. And then the video goes on and on. It's very graphic. He munches the brains, or it could be a she, munches the brains of the murder hornet until there is no head left. You will love it if you like gruesome things. And it's available online right now. And I should actually mention to you that Nature is Metal shares video of the wild animals in the wild who are killing and eating each other. So it is pretty graphic, but it's all natural.
We apologize to any listeners who may have been eating their lunch as they listen to Femi. Okay, the host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thanks as always.
Nature is cruel, Jeremy. You're welcome. Take care.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.